You're listening to Strange by Nature, your guide to the strange, weird, unbelievable, and improbable wonders of the natural world.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here today. I am Kirk Mona, and I am joined today by Rachel Ginza and Victoria Thompson. We are all professional naturalists who together have scoured the world for weird and wonderful wonders just to please your mammalian brain's desire for novelty. Isn't that nice? Let's do this.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode. This week, it is me and Rachel. How you doing?
Woo, I'm doing great. How are you doing, Kirk?
Doing fantastic.
Oh, great.
Before we jump into today's show too much, we got to give a shout out to our newest patron. We don't talk about our patron program a bunch. We really should. We're not good at tooting our own horns. Our newest patron is Ashley.
Hey.
So Ashley, hey, thanks for becoming a patron. Appreciate that. For the rest of you, you know, if you're sick and tired of hearing ads, you can join up over at patreon.com/strangebynature and join the Society of Strange. There's three different levels you can pledge at with different benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the levels, all the levels, you get ad-free episodes. So you get the episodes ad-free, which is really nice. And then also, you
get
some of the levels, you get bonus content. So you get some of our little extra stuff that we record that maybe doesn't make it in. Sometimes at the end of an episode, we might hang out a little bit and chat about some funny topics or funny stories and things. And we try to take some of that stuff and just put it out there to the patrons, because we really appreciate that they are helping this show be what it is. And you know, you can also help out just by listening to the ads, I guess, or you can help out, you know, by writing us 5-star reviews, by sharing us with friends, all those ways. So we appreciate all the different ways that people help this show keep going. So
yeah,
keep
very
at
much.
It. But if you want to head over to patreon.com/strangebynature, you can check that out as well. Rachel,
Kirk,
you got something for us this week?
Oh, do I, Kirk?
Oh, good.
All right. So my topic this week goes out to my friend Matt, who thought this would be right up my alley, and he was correct.
Okay.
But this also satisfies a current info spiral he's in. So here you go, Matt. Kirk, start this off. Have you ever heard of March Mammal Madness?
March Mammal Madness. No, I mean, I know that there's a lot of organizations that'll do some sort of March Madness thing, trying to pick like the best bird or the best bear or all that kind of stuff. But I don't think I've seen a mammal one.
Oh, well, it's not just mammals. So this is something that's put on by the Arizona State University. It is a competition that happens every March, very similar to March Madness for basketball.
Right.
Yep. Except it's for nerds. Okay. So it's a bracket tournament, and it pits organisms against each other. There's different categories and such that get put together every single year. This year, the categories are epic animals, connoisseur critters, rainbow collection, and take a bow.
Wow.
And let me tell you, it's a wild time. I have my bracket filled out, and I'm really... I'm really pulling for one of the animals that's on this list is the, I think, the giant squid. So I'm really pulling for the giant squid. Y'all wouldn't be surprised by my bracket. The top four that I have.
No. All from the ocean.
They're all from the ocean. Yeah, they are. Or,
now, is this something that the public votes on these then, or how are they chosen?
Great question. So it's a great time because it's actually a lot of research and researchers get into this. So they actually cite their sources of why certain creatures win different bouts. So happens is when a battle, I say with air quotes on a podcast that is an audio medium.
Lovely.
When a battle takes place, what happens is they pretty much like pit the two animals against each other, and it's not necessarily just animals sometimes, or mammals even. I think it started off as mammals, but it is spread throughout the animal kingdom. Like this year, for example, there's a cobra lily and like a pitcher plant and So there's other things that are
so
on
we're not
this.
Even doing just animals, yeah.
No, sometimes there are plants on there. And it's primarily used as a way to engage students in researching and get them to do something fun. So there's actually like lesson plans on how you can incorporate this into science lessons in schools, which is really cool. Okay. But how they decide whether a critter wins or not, each battle takes place somewhere on the planet. It could be in the home habitat of one creature and not another, or it could be in the middle of the Saharan desert where neither animal or plant lives. And what happens is if an animal leaves, so to speak, their natural tendency is to leave leave the area when there's like a big scary predator, or if one of them eats the other, is more likely to eat the other. Like, I'm going to spoil one part of the most recent bracket. Sure. They had a bee eater against a bee. You'll never guess what happened, Kirk.
Did the bee get eaten?
The bee got eaten.
All right. Well, there you go.
Yeah. But it's this wild time, right? And because of that, it's just really fun to be able to see which way it goes. It's like this big thing at my workplace, and we end up having like a so-called winner of March Mammal Madness. It becomes like a huge thing.
Okay, so they're encouraging you to like, and students do research ahead of time and look at the bracket, look at the species and go, I think this one would win this matchup. Therefore, I'm going to move it on. And then
it
kind of forces you or gives you the opportunity to kind of learn along the way and make your best guesses.
Exactly.
Cool. I'm in.
Right? It's super fun. I'm also going to wish my friend David, a different friend now, you could do the research, which what you were describing, or you could do what my friend David did and just flip a coin for each battle to see who would win. And you could end up with something like he did, where the cobra lily apparently is winning it all. I don't hold a lot of hope for David.
Yeah, I'm not.
But it's a bold choice.
Choices were made. Yep. Way to go, David.
Anyway.
Live your best self.
So one of the categories that I talked about is epic animals. And the epic animals, it's epic as in storytelling. Like, animals
like
that are
epic,
part of mythology or folklore are really well known in and are really heavily featured in lots of storytelling. Like they had raven and wolf and a variety of other
coyote.
Animals. I don't think coyote was in this year.
Coyote is such a great one. Okay.
It is a really good one. And we've covered some of the animals on the podcast that are actually in March Mammal Madness this year. Always really is really fun, especially like the wild card winner of this year is one that I covered and I think is pretty great. So one of the creatures in Epic Animals is pretty famous. It's a large mammal that lives in the sea. So we're going to the ocean today, Kirk.
Rachel. I am so shocked you would go to the ocean.
Who would have thunk?
Who would have thought, yeah.
Kirk, when I say a large mammal that lives in the ocean that has to do
whale.
In that is in the context of epics and storytelling, what animal do you think of?
Whale.
What mammal?
Whale.
What kind of whale?
Okay. Humpback. I say like blue whale.
A blue whale. That's a good one. It is on my list. Today we're talking about the sperm whale.
Oh, one of the whales that I have seen.
Ooh,
in the wild. Yeah.
That's so cool.
When I was in Norway, we went on a sort of a whale safari up in the Lofoten Islands and got to go out on a ship and go look for whales.
Oh, that's so cool, Kirk.
It was.
That's so wild. So,
after all the throwing up of everybody on board, it was real cool.
Oh my gosh. I'm so sorry,
it was a little
Kirk.
Choppy. Yeah, no, you got to get through it.
Yeah.
You're just chumming the waters is what you're doing.
Well, a good thing that you were doing that, because then you got to see the sperm whale.
We did, yeah.
Yeah. So a sperm whale, I don't know if you knew this, but it's the largest toothed whale on the planet.
Yeah, super
cool. Yeah. So when I say toothed whale, it's in the same category as like porpoises and orcas and some other like smaller whales. It's not in the same category of whale like the blue whale or the humpback whale. Those are
the baleen whales.
Those are the baleen whales.
Filter feeders,
They are way bigger, which is wild because they eat some of the smallest things.
Yeah, it seems really weird, right?
It feels wild. But they grow way bigger. But this is the largest toothed whale. And it's...
Yeah, sperm whales are crazy.
It is not lacking in size. It just puts into context a little bit for me that the baleen whales are huge. So they're really cool. Sperm whales, they can get up to 49 to 59 feet long and weigh 35 to 45 tons. So to put that into context, that's 70,000 to 90,000 pounds. And between 9 and 11 Rachels stacked up on each other is how big a sperm whale is. Did do that math. I'm really proud of myself.
That's good.
Sperm whales are pretty unique for whales in general. They have a really square head. And which is unique because most whales are pretty streamlined, you know, because you have to dive. A lot of whales, including the sperm whale, actually dive down and then come back up. You want to be more aerodynamic, but the sperm whale has a pretty blunt nose and is very square. And their head is actually a third of their body size, which...
Right, yeah. They count for that huge mouth, right?
It counts for the really large mouth, which can house up to 52 teeth. Like cone teeth.
It's a lot of chompers.
Just in their lower jaw. They don't really have teeth in their upper jaw, as far as I can tell.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
They just are in their lower jaw to like just chomp and tear. But there are these conical teeth, which is wild. Yeah. And that third of their body size houses the largest brain in the animal kingdom.
Ooh, nice. Okay.
So even though the blue whale is larger and is the largest animal that has ever lived on the planet Earth, sperm whales have the largest brain.
That probably makes sense. I mean, I know size is not necessarily correlated with intelligence, but if you are a predatory whale versus a filter feeding whale, I gotta imagine having a larger brain would be a huge advantage.
Right. You have to do a lot of complex thinking. You're hunting actively. Sperm whales use echolocation as well because when they are diving down, they're actually diving down. They're found in just about every ocean there is, but they dive down super deep. They dive. I have it written down, actually. I was going to say it later, but I'm going to say it now. They go and they use echolocation and they can dive down to the ocean, down in the depths of the ocean, to 3,000 meters, or for us non-scientists, 10,000 feet deep in the ocean.
That's deep.
Yeah.
That's real deep.
So if you're down that deep, you don't really have great use of your eyes. You're going to be catching motion. You're using echolocation and vocalizations to find not only the rest of your pod, so the family that the sperm whales will live in, they'll stick together, but you're also using it to try to find food because you have a lot of food that you have to eat. So that big head of theirs is really important. And in fact, it actually houses what gives sperm whales their namesake.
Oh, okay.
So in their head, they have an oil gland. It's a pretty big oil gland, and it is the reason why sperm whales were so popular in whaling, because that oil was super valuable and they're actually able to use it for candle making, for lubricants, just for a whole slew of things.
It was used for tons. I mean, before we really had petroleum, that was the thing, you know,
that's what made lamps go, you know?
Yeah. Well, and like I said, kept gears lubricated. Like, I mean, it was used everywhere.
Exactly. And
as long as you're near the ocean, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. But that oil has like a whitish substance or whitish coloring to it.
Lovely.
So when whalers opened up the whale and found the gland, they literally thought it was sperm and that it came out of the whale's head.
Okay.
So the oil is called, yep, the oil is called spermaceti.
Don't like that.
I feel like I have to say this. I shouldn't, but I feel like I have to. It's okay. Not sperm.
Yeah, no, it's not.
It's not. They are mammals. They have they have penises. They have vaginas. Like all sperm whales have spermaceti and have this oil. Scientists are still kind of debating some of the uses that sperm whales use spermaceti for. One of the ways that they think that the sperm whales use spermaceti is actually as a way to focus sound into their brain, into the right bits.
I was wondering about that.
Bits.
Okay, yeah.
So that way they can, because if you're down 3,000 meters, there's not any light for you to be able to use. So if you can't focus the sound exactly to where exactly to where your prey is,
mm-hmm.
Then if you miss, then that's it. You might not find something for the rest of the day. And as a mammal, you're creating your own body heat. You have to be able to
eat.
It's really important.
Yeah.
So it's wild. So that's one use of it. Another thought is that they use the spermaceti for buoyancy, potentially.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one thought that came to mind. Sort of like a swim bladder would be in a fish.
Exactly.
Or I think even sharks will use more like, they use oil, but I think more around their liver or something like that, mm-hmm. like in place in lieu of a swim bladder. So that when you're talking about like a large volume of oil in your body, I'm like, aha, buoyancy.
Aha. That doesn't like water.
It could, like many things in nature, can serve more than one purpose too.
Exactly. It probably does. That would make a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
Especially since I mentioned that they go down super deep into the ocean. Like, oh my gosh. It's a good thing that they have really good lung capacity as well, because sperm whales are able to hold their breath up to 2 hours.
Oh, that's 2 hours is just...
It's a long time. To give some comparison, humans can go without fresh oxygen on average 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Some people can train themselves to go longer, but on average it's 3 minutes. And then we start getting into trouble. Beavers have better lung capacities than we do. It's like, what is it, like 15 minutes at least?
Yeah, I don't know the exact number on beavers. I do know, though, when I was looking for sperm whales and when I've seen like other whales too, once you see them dive, if they flip their tail or their fluke, up in the air to do a dive, it's like, well, that's done now.
That's
we're
it.
Not gonna, might as well go find some other whales, because this one is gone for a long time.
Yep. And that's because they're holding their breath for 2 hours, which actually is another weird thing about a sperm whale. When they blow that air out, it only comes out on their blowhole is like segmented into two different sides, like right and left. And it only comes out of the left side.
Huh. On all of them, huh?
Uh-huh. Which is
on
weird.
On all of them?
On all of them. Which is...
That's cool.
Weird, but and very unique. Good for them.
That's how the sperm whale do.
Yeah. So when they're diving down and holding their breath for an insane amount of time, they actually are going down to hunt another creature that we've had on the show. A variety of them, actually, we've had on the show. They are looking for those squid. That is actually what came into context for a lot of mythology around, like... Not giant squid, because giant squid do exist, but like the monster squid that
like the
everybody
Kraken
was
kind of thing,
like the Kraken and everything, because they would come up with all of these scars all over their faces and bodies, because they are, their favorite food is squid. So they're fighting and eating colossal squid. They're fighting and eating giant squid. Super tasty snack. They also eat things like sharks and skates and fish. Generally anywhere from 3 to 3.5% of their body weight every day is how much they're eating. So they're eating a lot of food to keep going. That's all I have about sperm whales. There's so much more that I can say about sperm whales, but I've already like taken up a lot of time, and I actually didn't mention one thing that I might be coming back to. But I can give you a little spoiler when it comes to March Mammal Madness. They did make it past the first round in March Mammal Madness this year. And hopefully with the context of what everything that I just said, it can give you a little more of that epicness that is this creature. So that's all I have for you this week. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, it'll be Kirk.
So, have you ever thought about what would happen if your airline window popped out? Or if you could build a jetpack using only machine guns? Turns out you can, but you really, really shouldn't. Hi, I'm Jill Chacha, host of a podcast that's for weird people who like learning about weird stuff. It's called, Well, That's Interesting, and it's a comedy science-y show that tells the story behind the facts because those stories are funny. Every Thursday, I tell the tale behind an odd new discovery, like how researchers found two mysterious structures surrounding Earth's core, or how it's actually possible to stop hiccups using a rectal massage. Yes, there's a story behind that. No pun intended. And I tell the story because storytelling is the perfect way to learn and remember. The facts are bizarre, the stories are epic, and the laughter is plentiful. So, join the flock and listen. Well, That's Interesting, wherever you do podcasts.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Now, Rachel, there's a you brought up something funny in your story that you'll see why I had to sort of smiled when you brought this up. But for 13 years, I worked at a place called Warner Nature Center, and it was Minnesota's oldest nature center. But sadly, it shut down a few years after I left. And while I was there, though, there were some really amazing times. And it was fun to learn about some of the stories of the times from before I had worked there, because it had been open for, you know, over 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there, like I said, for 13 years. But the center had actually opened in, I believe, 1965. And by the time I got there, we had all these empty concrete pads in the woods. Some that had like cages on them. Okay. And I asked about this, and it turns out the center used to do animal rehab as well as doing like education stuff. And this is kind of before there was like a dedicated rehab center in the area that we live in. And so it was really wild to hear some of the just absolutely bonkers stories from the time about some of these animals they took in and whatnot.
I'm not even
there was
surprised.
Also, it was kind of the Wild West back then. there was also stories of introductions. So they were trying to establish populations of missing species when the land was transitioned from essentially farmland to nature center. So they looked at what was missing and they tried to add it in. They released turkeys. They released Canada geese. And notably for the story I have want to tell today, they released beavers.
Oh,
and you had just mentioned beavers.
I did just talk about beavers. Oh, yeah. Fun.
Now, I may have mentioned a little part of this either on the show or maybe when we were talking with our patrons, but the story I heard at the time when they wanted to reintroduce beavers is they put out the call, put out the words saying, hey, we're looking for some beavers. And eventually one turned up. I don't know if this was the DNR or some trappers. I don't recall that part of the story. But I think it was there was some beavers that were nuisance beavers that were trapped. And they're like, hey, yeah, no, we'd rather relocate them than kill them. So we'd be happy to give them to you.
There's
so these beavers show up.
Real nuisance beavers out there, Kirk. I've talked and taught many a wild nuisance beaver story.
Oh, there you go. Well, these beavers show up. They didn't like knock on the door. It was, you know, someone brought them. But they showed up right at the end of the workday. And people needed to get home to their families. And the lake is a bit of a hike from the main building, and the beaver, I guess, actually beavers, were still in cages. So they figured, well, look, we're just going to wait until the next morning to release them. Beavers are heavy. They can weigh up to 60 pounds. So at first I was like, wow, that's so lazy. Just why don't you take them down there? It's like, well, okay, if you've got 120 pounds worth of beavers and this particular nature center, the lake was not really nearby the building. So it would have been, you know, kind of a long walk, probably at least 10 minutes down to the lake, at least 10 minutes to let them go, at least 10 minutes to walk back. And an extra half an hour at the end of the day, staff was like, we can't. We all have commitments and we didn't know they were coming today. So they put them in the classroom downstairs, close up the building, and come back the next morning only to discover the beavers have escaped the cages because they're very clever. And they had had free reign of the building all night.
Oh, no.
And the beavers, wanting to get outside, had gone up to the second story of the building and discovered these enormous, absolutely enormous picture windows that are like probably 6 feet high and 12 feet long. Along kind of the whole back of the building. Just, it was a very cool building. And these are only about a foot off the ground. So the beavers wanted to get through this invisible force field, chewed the wood off of every windowsill in the entire building by morning time. They did a lot of damage. Now by the time that I got there decades later, the descendants of those clever beavers were still living on the lakes of the nature center, which is really cool.
That is cool. Wait, did they actually escape, or were they just had some fun snacks?
No, they did not get out. They just snacked on the windowsills and other things in the building, and then the staff had to round them up and get them down to the lake. I'm not really sure if they actually got them back into the traps and down to the lake, or if they just opened the doors and were like, get out, just find your own way to the lake.
Good luck.
I don't recall that part of the story, yeah.
Listen for the sound of running water. Good luck.
Yeah, you'll figure it out. You know, this was not a, aside from all the damage, this is not a difficult, you know, relocation. Just put them in a pickup truck or something and drive them, you know, to the nature center. But sometimes beavers need to be relocated to even more remote locations. And there's a few ways you can do that. If there are roads of any kind, you can take a truck or like an ATV. Beavers have been carried places in backpacks.
I've talked about that story, yes.
Yeah, really not fun. If you have 50 miles or something to go, I've even seen photos of beavers being transported on horseback. They basically put a box on each side of the horse, like saddlebags.
That is a wild thing to do.
Yeah. And these methods have all been developed because sometimes you need to get beavers to these remote locations. And if there's no roads, you know, you got to find a way to get them there.
Kirk, are you talking about the relocation that I'm thinking about?
Maybe. You have to wait and see.
Okay.
In the old days, beavers were mostly relocated because they were a nuisance. Although we did know that they had, you know, beneficial environmental, you know, reasons for relocating them as well. We now really, I think, understand that they can be beneficial to habitat. And the relocation I want to talk about, Rachel, I think you might know where this is going.
I think
end of World War II, some folks came up with what has got to be the most amazing beaver relocation method ever.
Quite simply,
they threw them out of airplanes.
Yes!
Specifically, before you think this is too cruel, they threw them out with parachutes. Now,
This is the one I thought you were talking about!
If you're picturing beavers jumping out of a plane with their goggles on and little mini parachute packs on their backs, I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed. That's not what they did. They actually created...
The only image that will live in my brain, though.
I know. It's just fabulous. They created two-part boxes like that were like a bottom and a lid. And you could put two beavers in, and then a parachute could be attached to that. And when the boxes would land, I got varying information. Some said that the lids would spring open. Some reports said the beavers actually had to push the top off to get out. But at any rate, they would land and then they could escape into the wild. So to be clear, this is completely bonkers.
Oh, that is so bonkers.
I mentioned this was just after World War II. This actually has a lot to do with World War II. So this was in Idaho. And at the end of the war, there was a, you know, population increase in many places around the country. Mm-hmm. And many returning vets and other people began to move out of cities and into more rural areas where they wanted to build homes. Mm-hmm. And this created more conflicts between humans and beavers. Essentially, humans created more nuisance beavers. The beavers are just doing their thing, but suddenly they were a nuisance.
Right.
And those complaints, at least in Idaho, were directed to the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. I suppose if you didn't live in Idaho, you could still direct your complaints to them. They would just ignore you. Now, the Idaho Department of Fish and Game could have just shot the beavers. I give them credit for not doing that. They chose instead to relocate the beavers when they got the complaints.
It's like, especially in like the 1950s, instead of like, they decided to relocate the beavers instead of just shooting the beavers.
Well, there's a reason why. There's a really good reason why.
Ooh.
Because the Idaho Department of Fish and Game were the people who had reintroduced beavers in the first place to Idaho. So beavers had been wiped out, essentially, from all of Idaho. And they were like, no, we actually paid money to, like, relocate beavers to Idaho. So we don't really want to just kill them because we brought them here. We had reintroduced them. And so, like, it was, not good just to undo your hard work there. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, where can we put them where they're not going to be a nuisance, and also where we maybe want beavers where we don't think there are any right now? And so they moved them to the Chamberlain Basin in the Sawtooth Mountain Range in central Idaho. And Rachel, I realize you live in the Sawtooth Mountains in Minnesota.
Do.
Just to clarify here, not the same Sawtooth Mountains.
No.
So why parachutes, though? So I mentioned that Chamberlain Basin is very remote, and getting the beavers there was no easy task. And also remember, World War II had just ended. So there were lots of surplus airplanes.
Yep.
Sort of, it's weird to say surplus pilots, but there were pilots looking for, you know, work. You had lots of surplus parachutes and even paratroopers who understood how to use them.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, at the time, they did the math and calculated this out. Creating custom boxes with parachutes and flying the beavers to a new location and parachuting them down was actually both the safest and the most cost-effective way to move them, which, again, is absolutely nuts.
That's bonkers, very much.
76 beavers were thrown out of airplanes in what we call Operation Beaver Drop.
I love this.
They were packed two per crate. They were thrown out of the airplane at between 500 and 800 feet off the ground. So pretty high, but not like as high as a skydiver would or something like that. They're going much higher. They wanted to minimize the amount of time the beavers had to be, you know, up in the air there. 75 of the 76 survived. That means that one of them did die. But actually, that's a much higher survival rate than by horseback, which they had tried, and they found it was much less successful. Basically, the beavers were overheating when they were in these boxes with the horses.
Yeah, and probably super stressed.
Yeah, and very stressed out. I'm sure the airplane thing was stressful too, but overall, they showed that it was less stressful for them.
Mm-hmm.
I will say the one beaver that died, we do know why. This is kind of a bummer. He or she successfully forced themselves out of the box before it landed.
That's not great.
That's when it would have been handy to have the little individual parachute on his back and the goggles.
Yep.
So I will say parachuting beavers have become very famous and even more widely known ever since long lost footage of the operation was discovered and then digitized and put online in 2022. You can watch it on YouTube. You can watch beavers be parachuted into Idaho. If any of you are in Idaho and know about this, you can write in contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com or in the Podbean app, let us know. From what I understand, like in Idaho, a lot of people know this story and are especially proud of what they call their para beavers. There's like t-shirts and all kinds of stuff you can get. So that sounds pretty wild. I do have an interesting addendum to this story, though. So it's not just about the Operation Beaver Drop. Remember, these beavers were mostly moved because they were a nuisance elsewhere. Like that was the biggest thing. Like, yeah, we know beavers are good for, you know, to have as part of nature because they're missing, but mostly these are a nuisance and that's why we're going to get them out of here. And this isn't that the Idaho Fish and Game Department didn't understand the value of beavers. They absolutely did, which is why they relocated them instead of killing them. But habitat restoration and ecological balance wasn't maybe like their primary reason, from what I understand, of doing this. And I'm sure most listeners will recall, how could we not? how smoky the past few summers have been. We've had just so many wildfires. And as someone who works outdoors, I can tell you last year just about killed me. It was so bad. I mean, I basically was coughing and hacking all summer long.
We're in high fire risk right now.
We're already right back into it. Well, NASA, it turns out, helped out with a study that looked at the photos of Idaho burn areas. And wildfires did pass through the Chamberlain Basin. And what they're able to show was that the areas where the descendants of the para-beavers lived fared far better than those without beavers. The beavers basically, because of all their, you know, dams and whatnot, kept more water impounded on the land. It's not running downstream as fast. And when you have all these ponds and things, that it creates more lush green vegetation around those. And so you have this much more, I'll say, verdant green landscape because of beavers. It's not that any more rainfall falls magically on those areas, but the beavers create a greener landscape just by being there. And so a lot of scientists and planners and whatnot and ecologists are now looking at how the introduction of beavers can continue and help us prevent some of the massive scale of wildfires we've been seeing, which is just
so
fantastic.
Cool.
Yeah. Now, I will say the economics of para-beavers don't really work out anymore. It's too expensive to do it that way. I don't think we're going to see any more parachuting beavers anytime soon, but it's a really cool part of the history of our country and the history of Idaho and the history of, you know, just how we've worked with ecology and the landscape and trying to restore things. So very, very fun. I will say my sources week were some articles on Vox, Wikipedia, and Atlas Obscura.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Kirk.
Absolutely.
Oh, so good.
Parachuting beavers. Woo!
Woohoo! Oh, my gosh. This is so fun.
Oh, my gosh. Super fun. Well, thanks for coming and chatting with me this week. And thanks to all of you, our listeners.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to today's show. Be sure to subscribe. New episodes drop every Wednesday, and we love sharing this strange world with all of our listeners. If you would be so kind as to leave us a 5-star review, that would be great. It lets other lovers of the strange discover the show. You can reach out to us on social media by searching for Strange by Nature Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can send us an email as well. Our address is contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. If you want more information about the show, you can also check out our website, which is strangebynaturepodcast.com. Until next week, get outside, stay curious, and embrace the strange.